Welcome. You've tuned into Beyond Academia, the LSC-sponsored podcast for adventurous research students. I'm Peter Harrington, and with the help of expert guests, we're going to explore career options, skill sets, and research opportunities you don't typically find on the traditional academic runway. So buckle up, get set for the journey, and let's go places on what I hope will be a thought-provoking ride. In this introductory episode, I explore some of the key issues that impact on and affect the modern research student who is not necessarily seeking a career in academia. With the help of expert guests who both have first-hand experience of studying for a PhD, I discuss ambitions, day-to-day challenges, and look closely at how people who often juggle work and intense study manage their busy lives. Later, I'll be talking with Hitendra Solanki, who specialises in mindfulness. But first, I caught up with Johan Idawella, who currently is doing his PhD and also has his own startup company. Johan Idawella, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Johan, I believe you're in the third year of your PhD. So what's your story and what's PhD life like for you?
That's correct. I'm in the third year of my PhD in economic geography here at LSE. And I suppose I've had a slightly unusual journey into the PhD. I'm originally from Australia. I did my undergraduate degree there in law and international relations. But all the way through, I was dabbling with starting businesses and working in finance. After I graduated, I ended up working for the Australian Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet, in areas ranging from economic development to eventually national security. And after working in the national security space for a while, I really wanted to go out and do some more sort of positive developmental work. And that would involve, in most cases, the need for a master's degree. So I came over to LSC because it had a fantastic master's degree in local economic development. And that program actually opened up the door to some work in Uganda, working with the World Bank there. And so we went and surveyed a bunch of businesses in Uganda, trying to work out what the barriers were to competitive firms in Kampala, the capital city there. And we found that one of the biggest barriers was actually corruption in subnational governments. I thought that was a really interesting problem and decided to look at what the academic literature was saying about this and didn't find anything. So it was a bit of a light bulb moment for me and thought that I could actually write a PhD on the topic. So here we are many years later.
Okay, and you're living in London and you're, as you say, the third year of your PhD. And do you meet a lot of PhD students here in London?
Absolutely. You meet so many PhD students, not just from London or the UK, but from all around the world. We have many amazing academic conferences here that bring researchers doing the PhD and afterwards together. So it's a great opportunity to mix and get to know what life is like for PhD students everywhere.
And what do you think life is like for PhD students in general right now?
So based on my interactions and my own experience, I guess there are probably five things that define what life is like for a PhD student. Number one relates to structure. Number two relates to a lack of money. Number three is related to that, which is a lack of time. Number four is a constant source of stress, I suppose. And number five is concerns about the future.
Okay. So do you want to elaborate a bit more? Let's talk to me a bit about structure. I was interested when you said that.
Structure is an interesting one, and it affects a lot of PhD students. Many PhD students have come straight from a master's program. And a master's program is an incredibly structured environment. You have a set timetable, you have deadlines for essays, so you know what time you need to be at university and what time you can leave. When you enter the PhD program, all those structures are removed and you're essentially left on your own. And it can be quite challenging to set up your own structures and routines. So So after structure, I suppose the next thing that most PhD students can relate to is a lack of money. It's a sort of rite of passage, unfortunately, for many of us PhD students. The reality is we don't get huge bursaries, and the cost of living in a place like the UK is incredibly high. So most of us are constantly concerned about money. You have to really take a cut from your previous working experience, if you have worked previously, to adjust the lifestyle that you live. And this also necessitates most PhD students having to do extra work on the side. So that could be consulting work, that could be extra research work, that could be lecturing. And of course, that leads into the third issue.
Of course, that impacts on time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that affects time, because the more money that you need, the less time that you have to actually work on your research. And this can be quite frustrating at times, because you really want to be spending your entire PhD focused on research, focused on learning very critical sort of esoteric skills that you wouldn't be able to learn elsewhere unless you were in academia.
And I suppose that lack of time and lack of money leads to that fourth point, which you mentioned, which was stress.
Exactly. And there are a number of different sources of stress, but what I see speaking to a lot of PhD students and in my own experience is you present your ideas in a PhD constantly, and that's through conferences, that's through journal publications or journal submissions, and you get lots of critical feedback. And that critical feedback can be really hard to digest, because you've often spent months or years perfecting an idea, and the criticism isn't delivered in the most friendly way. So that's certainly a source of stress.
Finally, you mentioned, I believe it was future. Well, what do you mean when you said
future? In terms of future, I'd say over 50% of PhD students enter the PhD program with an expectation that they'll end up in academia. But what we're actually seeing now is that there's a proliferation of PhD programs, which means there's a proliferation of PhD students, but the opportunities in academia are contracting. So there's this huge demand for academic jobs with a very limited supply. And that competition is, again, a source of stress and a source of anxiety, and something that PhD students need to worry about, essentially.
So there's more people but fewer jobs.
Exactly.
In academia.
Yeah.
So, Johan, with regards to the points you make, you know, are there any tips or helpful advice that you can share?
Yes, I think there are two things that I'll touch upon. The first relates to structure, the second relates to stress. And creating structure is one of the behaviors or changes you can make which unlocks many other benefits. So in terms of structure, it's incredibly important to define your workday, set a routine. And the best way of doing that, and the easiest way of doing that, is just working 9 to 5, essentially treating a PhD like a job. That means that once 5 p.m. hits, the PhD is off your shoulders. You don't need to think about it anymore.
The monkey's off the back.
Exactly. And this is a sort of problem that one of my close friends had. He was doing a PhD here at LSE, and he was working from home. And he would go days without interacting with other humans. And that's quite a frustrating environment. You don't have a routine. And work was just surrounding him at all times. And it led to a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress, and eventually he dropped out of the first year.
And you think that was very much rooted in his lack of contact with people?
Lack of contact with people and a lack of a routine and structure. So different PhD programs treat this differently. So some PhD programs are quite collaborative. My PhD, for example, involves quite a lot of interaction with people. We co-author papers together. And having that collaborative element actually forces me to be at university on time and to establish a sort of routine, because you have these peer effects. When you do a more solo PhD, you don't have that. And so it becomes very easy to just stay at home and not really develop a routine, which, as I was saying before, it means that the PhD is constantly on your shoulders. In relation to stress, I mentioned that one of the huge problems is the way that feedback is given to you as a PhD student. And it's incredibly challenging to deal with because you spend so much time and you're so vested in the research. And it can be quite terrifying and at times a little depressing to receive really critical feedback in such a sort of abrasive way.
So when you say critical, it comes across as being negative. It's not just critical because it's trying to actually pick out key points.
Well, this is part of the problem. So you need to learn to divorce yourself from your research and realize that when you're receiving this sort of criticism, it's a criticism of your idea and not as you as a person. And that's a very hard thing to disentangle when your entire life is bound up with your research. And so I'd really recommend to PhD students or PhDs, potential PhD students rather, that they think about this separation, that a critique of their idea is not a critique of them as a person. And I think that knowing that can help mitigate some of the stress that PhD students go through.
And going back to that first point about your friend who wasn't getting out, wasn't mixing with people, part of the antidote is actually talking to your friends, talking to people who are going through the same experience, who are sharing it, who can help you through when you've had a bad day, when you've had feedback you weren't expecting.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, we're all social creatures. And just having someone who understands what you've gone through and what you are going through is incredibly useful. So I'd recommend going out, surrounding yourself with fellow PhD colleagues, and just developing a routine. And once you have a routine, that leads to, again, less stress.
Listening to Johan, it became clear that juggling work, life, and a PhD can create a lot of pressure. Given the rise in awareness of mental health issues in society, I felt here was a subject this podcast series should address. I wanted to find some ideas and answers. And after some of my own research, I managed to track down and interview Hitendra Solanki. Hitendra has worked as a humanitarian international aid worker, as well as an academic at the London South Bank University for many years. As a qualified mindfulness trainer, Hitendra has significant experience working with people who are affected by stress, and I began by asking him about his work with students.
Do you teach the students about how to be more resilient and how to manage stress?
Absolutely. And in fact, I've been prompted by the students more than from my own volition. It's absolutely an interest of mine to support everyone as best as I can through the work that I've done in the sector, the wellbeing work as well as the mindfulness, but definitely with the students. Teaching a master's course here at London South Bank University, I have a lot of students who are coming in. They have outside lives, they have stresses that they bring into the classroom, and then under the pressure cooker of trying to perform, get the assignments done, especially if they're foreign students who are coming in with a completely new context that they've left behind, you know, from their countries, a new environment, new places to live, etc. What you find that this all accumulates into a stress that really builds up and often will demonstrate itself in the classroom sometimes. They prompted me, you know, I'm having a lot of stress, what can we do? And then with my mindfulness background, I put two and two together and said, okay, let's do this. So a lot of the support work that I started was very informal.
And when was that you started that?
So I've been doing mindfulness training with the students now probably for the past 4 or 5 years.
And can you say what mindfulness actually is?
Yes, absolutely. So mindfulness meditation is, as it says, it's a meditation. But it's a way of training the attention and a training the focus of the mind. So if, for example, your mind is wandering too much in terms of planning and doing things, it's very much in the future. If it's ruminating about things, it's too much in the past. Training the attention to focus onto the present moment. So, for example, with the breath, allows you to actually stop being too much in the future with all this thinking going on in your mind or worrying about things potentially in the past, and actually finding a different way of being which is actually centered in the here and now.
So it's a different way of being?
It's a completely different way of being in terms of what we are normally brought up to be, which is doing, 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 and thinking, thinking, adding more thinking onto the thinking that we have, and then adding more thinking. But what the mindfulness does is that it gives you an idea of what's actually going on cognitively, what's happening in the mind. So as you train the attention to be present, so for example, focus on the breath, you become aware of how the mind actually works in the way the mind behaves. And bit by bit, what happens is that you become aware of cognitively, is the mind going too fast? Am I ruminating about something? Am I dwelling on usual things that keep coming up habitually? It also gives you a sense of how your emotions are, really understanding what's happening at an emotional level. And in particular, it gives you a sense of being present physically as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of training to be present within the body and to be present within the moment within the body.
Okay.
And through that understanding of the cognitive elements, the emotional elements, and the physical elements, there is an understanding and a self-awareness of how you're actually being at any given time.
And can you share some positive experiences mm-hmm. as to how your work with mm-hmm. students has helped them?
Absolutely, yeah. So we have had many, many students with anxiety and depression issues, for example. And often they don't know how to manage that, which means that they can often just sit there ruminating about things, or the anxiety is building up and they don't know exactly how to potentially make it stop. You know, often people are looking for that big red button to make it stop, please let it go away. Many of my students would come often emotionally, you know, they're in tears or whatever. And partly this is all to do with the workload, the stresses externally as well, all building up into one. And with the mindfulness training, I often sit down with a group of students at a time, and with the sessions that I develop through the project, for example, we have an introduction to mindfulness session where we take everyone very, very gently, step by step, through the components of mindfulness, building a real good understanding of it in an experiential way. Mm-hmm. And after that, what we have actually found is going back, you know, speaking to them later, they've all come back and through a self-perception, you know, methodology, I guess, they've come back and said, that has actually really helped me to be present, to deal with some of the stresses, mm-hmm. and give me just another way of actually being able to manage a stressful situation internally. So the situation might not go away, and often, you know, stresses will not go away, but our relation to the stressor will change because of the way we've actually changed how we approach that internally.
Now, obviously, people listening mm-hmm. to this aren't going to be able to attend yeah. your classes, all of them anyway. Yeah. So what practical mm-hmm. advice can you offer them through this podcast?
So there are many, many ways that you can actually now access mindfulness, incredible ways. One of the quickest ways is an app called Headspace.
Headspace.
Okay. And Headspace is an app. I think there are some sort of free aspects to it before you maybe subscribe, but it's a good way of introducing yourself without any outlay. And they will take you through guided meditations, for example. So guided meditations that will actually step by step, sort of 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes at a time, introduce you to exactly how you might be able to train the attention, which is part of mindfulness training. And through that, give you a real flavor. The important thing here to understand is that the benefits are absolutely there, but it needs to be done in a very experiential way. It's not about cognitively understanding something. And if we can sit down, give ourselves a little bit of time, a little bit of spaciousness to invest in ourselves, simply to just be.
Is this every day?
It can start off with every day, and it would be recommended that we do every day. And it's akin to physical training. You're not going to get physically fit if you just do the odd one or two press-ups or push-ups. But if we can do a regular practice on a day-to-day basis, that all builds up. It's almost like training a muscle, mm-hmm. you know. The repetitions will build that muscle, and the repetitions of you actually training the attention with the mind will build the attentional muscle, as it were. So apps like that will help. But more importantly, if you want to actually progress further than just the basics, which an app might provide, and also to make sure that you have a safe and engaged manner in which you actually practice mindfulness, then it's best to actually to find a qualified trainer and see if you resonate with that trainer. And if you feel happy and comfortable with that trainer and you trust that trainer and they're qualified, for example, then that is the best way. That's probably the way to actually understand mindfulness in its true sense, because you've got a way of actually asking questions, getting feedback directly, and you do need that sort of two-way sort of dialogue. But also, they will take you step by step into a deeper practice, which an app is unlikely to probably provide.
I'm talking about deeper practice. Here you are at London South Bank University providing training. How common do you think within universities is that particular service?
That's a really, really interesting question, because it feels as though people are coming out of the woodwork. And so with some of the conferences that I've been to talking about mindfulness in education, mindfulness with postgraduate students, for example, there was a recent conference, which was the first conference back in May, which is about mental health and dealing with postgraduate mental health. And so I presented on mindfulness, and it's only there that I actually discovered that there's other people out there sort of really pioneering and pushing this out there. Of course, mindfulness itself is becoming very mainstream. So you can see that it's creeping in, you know, sometimes slow, sometimes fast in different sectors, which is a great thing. But for the academic side, I wasn't quite aware of it, other than some of the research that I'd read and some of the other books, but I didn't know individual people. But in the UK, going to these conferences, you suddenly realize actually there's little pockets of work being done on this, and it's getting faster and faster in terms of its rollout and getting more popular. And more importantly, it's actually getting normalized. People are actually accepting that, this is a way forward, this is a particular modality that we can help for well-being. Because, and again, a few years ago, I guess it doesn't help having a ponytail, but, you know, it was still pitched to be in that sort of airy-fairy, hippie, sandal-wearing, esoteric sort of, you know, is that meditation? You know, there was a separation between what science was saying and how people were perceiving meditation. That's completely changed now.
So its value is now being far better received.
I think it's become so mainstream that everybody seems to be talking about it, which is a wonderful thing. It's a double-edged sword, because often there's preconceptions, misconceptions, but it's allowing everyday people in everyday situations to realize its everyday value and have access to it. You know, so the apps, there's countless magazines on mindfulness out there on the racks these days.
And is there one website you would recommend people visit?
Well, the app is called Headspace. There is a website for them. But I would suggest maybe going to Mind. They have a Be Mindful website, which you might want to actually go and visit. I think that provides a lot of services and links to people that you can go to. There are a variety of other mindfulness training courses out there as well now, which are accepted. So you've got the mindfulness-based stress reduction way of training, which is what I've been trained in. And that originated by Jon Kabat-Zinn in the University of Massachusetts just over 40 years ago. And there are a variety of other ones. So there's mindfulness trainings called Breathworks, for example, that are quite well-known, quite well-respected as well. And these are actually available through trainers all around the country. So as well as finding out about mindfulness and using apps, potentially online sort of guided meditations, I would really, really recommend, you know, taking time and going to sort of introductory classes on meditation and seeing and trying it. It's, you know, we have a classical way of saying it's like the taste of an orange. Nobody can really describe it until you really taste it.
And in terms of results and positive results, what can a research student hope to see as a result of engaging in this kind of mindfulness work?
So there are countless sort of benefits that have now been credibly recorded academically.
So there's research on this?
There is a huge amount of research now. You know, the American Mindfulness Association, they have a table, for example, showing you the number of papers and scientific studies that have been done on mindfulness since 1980. And from about 2000, the number of papers actually have gone on almost exponentially. So you're pushing about 900 papers a year on a variety of aspects of mindfulness in this, mindfulness in that, in different sectors and different studies. So there are tens of thousands of papers out there at the moment. So the studies are there. But the benefits genuinely and more or less significantly all point to the same direction, which is to say that mindfulness has significant positive benefits on psychological well-being.
And in terms of calming people down, being able to focus on the present rather than worrying about the past or agonising about the future. Is this what you're saying?
That's exactly. So what they found is that with mindfulness meditation, because of the attentional training that we have, you know, coming back to a point of focus, not getting always carried away with our thinking, just having that particular exercise or technique of coming back, being mindful, studies have shown potentially a 70% drop in anxiety after taking an MBSR course, for example. They've shown that our working memory can improve. So, you know, when you go into a room and then suddenly, oh, why am I in this room? You knew you had a plan before you went into it. So your working memory improves, which is great, especially when you're learning to hold and retain memory. Our ability to focus and hold attention improves drastically because of that coming back and training the actual mind to be, you know, one-pointed. One of the areas that I'm working on now, and I actually presented at Vitae, is the whole idea of mindfulness and research skills. And it's something that I'm doing. I'm writing a little bit of a blog piece shortly on this. And essentially, if you can understand that the more self-aware you become, and mindfulness is a vehicle to allow you to become self-aware, the more self-aware you can become, you can imagine that the potential for understanding bias and unconscious bias becomes enhanced, mm-hmm. which means that your ability to be more objective and remove as much of your own self-bias, you know, that
so
is
so you research better and you write better.
Absolutely. The other thing as well we found is that not only are you more present, but because your ability to then communicate your own particular needs with other people and your understanding of yourself, that self-awareness that is sort of nurtured by yourself, that self-awareness means that you are more prone to be self-aware of other people and other people's needs. And in the terms of sort of reflexivity, when we do research, how you are potentially can impact the research or the interview, for example.
So you're suggesting there that if you develop mindfulness skills, mm-hmm. you become more emotionally intelligent as well.
That is one of the key findings of a myriad of research, that you become much more emotionally intelligent, much more what they call emotion regulation strategies are much better, because you recognize an emotion, you know how to deal with it quicker and more skillfully rather than just habitually get carried away with a reactive response, for example. But in terms of that reflexivity, for example, if you're interviewing somebody, perhaps being self-aware of how you are in the moment, being aware of your thinking, potential biases, and being able to be more skillful and neutral means that that reflexivity is improved rather than a real sort of effect and or a negative effect or a positive effect. So yeah, it can enhance quite a lot.
Well, that sets the scene on modern life for busy PhD students. Whether you're starting out on your research journey, looking to explore new horizons, or seek better ways to juggle the pressures of everyday life, I really hope you have some new food for thought. Thanks go to my guests, Yohan Idawella and Hitendra Solanki, for their time and expertise. My name's Peter Harrington, and you've been listening to Beyond Academia. Go well on your journey, wherever it takes you.